Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Did you know that 75% of us are walking around every day chronically dehydrated? You know the feeling, the chronic headaches, the energy slumps, and poor focus. Well, it doesn't have to be this way, and that's thanks to one of our sponsors, Hydrant. Hydrant created a refreshing electrolyte powder that you mix directly into your water to efficiently and effectively hydrate your body. And whether you're drinking Hydrant first thing in the morning to start your day off on the right foot, or before a workout to perform at your best, or any other time throughout the day, you'll really feel the difference of being fully hydrated. Each Rapid Hydration Mix has a precise blend of electrolytes that helps your body hydrate quickly and stay hydrated all day. And Hydrant is backed by research. The formula was developed by an Oxford scientist to provide perfectly balanced, efficient hydration. And there's no synthetic colors, stevia, or artificial sweeteners. And the formula is vegan, and you can choose between three amazing flavors or a variety pack. So for 25% off your first order, go to drinkhydrant.com/first or enter promo code FIRST at checkout. That's drinkhydrant.com/first or promo code FIRST for 25% off your first order. Drinkhydrant.com/first or promo code FIRST.
The first degree.
You see it on the paper. You see it on Facebook.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
He had really piercing eyes. His eyes were like black, kind of like Ted Bundy, those kind of eyes. But was I scared of him? Hell no. Not a bit, but I should have been.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Vanek. I'm sitting far away from Alexis Linkletter and Billy Jensen. I'm really upset that we haven't done or started our social distancing recording situation, you guys. This is still hurting me.
Maybe next week.
Next week should be good.
This is reliant on Billy, really.
We all have a place that's big enough, and I have disinfectant wipes and a shield visor that I can wear.
You know what? Maybe that's an extra precaution that we could take, is wearing a shield visor as we record, because we can't use a mask.
Well, me and Jack have been seeing each other on a socially distant level outside only, and I'm swear by this tinted shield visor that I wear, and I won't take it off, so I will wear that.
Well, you wear it while we have a conversation, but it's so tinted that I can't see your face at all, so I don't know what expression you're making. If you're looking at me at all, I can barely hear you.
So you're like cosplaying Darth Vader.
That's how I sleep. I'm usually asleep when people talk to me. It's fine.
Yeah, it is a very Darth Vader vibes. Daft Punk. Billy, what day is it today?
There's a lot of good days today. National Creative Ice Cream Flavor Day. What is your favorite creative ice cream flavor? That is the question. I will start. Humphrey Slocum makes a cornflakes and whiskey. Cornflakes and whiskey. It's excellent.
Of course, you know this really obscure thing. My creative ice cream flavor situation that I have enjoyed in the past, it's not my favorite, but Salt and Straw does this, or they did this Thanksgiving dinner series. It was very weird. Like, they had a mashed potatoes flavor. There was a turkey flavor where they had caramelized turkey pieces in the ice cream, and it was delicious. But Billy, I'm actually kind of pissed that you didn't mention that today is National Chicken Wing Day.
That was going to be my next one. Look at her. Look at Alexis's face.
If you could see Alexis's face.
You are a cruel man.
Listen to me.
You know, chicken wings is my favorite food. You know that is my favorite food in the whole world. And you chose ice cream day first?
I was waiting for, I didn't want to go, we wouldn't be able to talk about the ice cream if I went with chicken wings first. So we led up to the chicken wings.
You're right, because the ice cream would have been kind of a downfall. So yeah, exactly. I like that build up to the chicken wings. All right, well, that's enough of that. So let's turn down the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you.
We'll be right back.
Army brats. You've heard the term. Children with one or both parents serving full-time in the military. The age of the phenomenon has meant military brats have also been described by a number of researchers as one of America's oldest and yet least well-known and largely invisible subcultures. The military brat lifestyle typically involves moving to a new state or to a new country many, many times over while growing up. Other shaping forces, or rather implications of this lifestyle, include a culture of resilience and adaptivity, constant loss of friendship ties, parents that are literally and figuratively militant in their parenting style, and of course, never ever having a hometown or roots anywhere. It can be extremely difficult to track military brats down or find out where they've lived, where they've been, where they ended up, what they ended up doing. And for this reason, the military brat lifestyle really is the perfect foundation for someone who really, really doesn't want to be found.
So today's case takes us back to June 8th of 1963, and a lot was happening this week. The song topping the charts was It's My Party by Leslie Gore, and the movie playing in theaters was Cleopatra starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. Also, Johnny Depp was born, and the Rolling Stones' first single, Come On, was released in the UK. The president of the U.S., JFK, signed the Equal Pay Act of 1963 into law, and he also suspended nuclear testing to work towards a nuclear test ban treaty.
The setting for today's case is a city in Germany called Bad Kreuznach, also known as BK. Since its earliest recorded history, BK has had a legacy of military influence. It was badly damaged by a number of air raids during the last months of World War II, and following the war, the first French and then American forces have been continually based in the city.
The base in BK was home to thousands of military men, women, and their children. And one of those army brats who was spending her high school years on the base was our first degree, Barbara.
My family was stationed in Italy at one time, Germany, and Japan, and Alaska, back when it might as well not have been a state. And you learn, when you move like every year to 2 years, you have to get to know people fast. Because, you know, I could come home tomorrow and my dad says, oh, guess what? We're being transferred to Timbuktu. So when I got to Germany, I think we only had 400 people in the high school. And that was 7th grade and 8th grade plus high school. We went back to Germany. There were four of us in the family. My dad asked to be stationed at Bad Kreuznach. And that's a beautiful town on the Nahe River, not too far from Frankfurt. And, you know, in the military back then, you moved almost every year. It was hard. So we got there when I was in 8th grade. Everybody knows everybody's business. All the kids knew all the kids. My dad was in World War II. The war had ended. My dad was over there near the end of the war. So, yeah, I mean, everybody knew what everybody else was doing. Nobody had telephones, though. Germany didn't have phones back then. Only a few people had a telephone that they could really use. Because this was 63. You know, the war had only been over for, 15 years or so?
So Barbara had a very tight group of girlfriends on the base, and one of these friends was named Margaret Williams. Margaret was the 15-year-old daughter of Lieutenant Colonel Robert Williams of Clarksville, Tennessee, and he was also an Army chaplain and Protestant minister.
I met Margaret. I probably met her in 8th grade, but I didn't become friends with her till 9th grade. She was quiet, shy, naive. She had no graces about her as far as dealing with people. And my heart always went out to that student that didn't fit in, or, you know, I would get to know him because I was a big mouth. I knew everybody. And I just befriended her. She was as sweet as she could be.
The children of the soldiers stationed at the base attended the BK American High School.
When school started freshman year, Margaret was in all my classes. If you were a freshman, everybody had the same classes together, all the same teachers. We would hang together and eat lunch. We had a building that was turned into a club for kids. It was open every day. So that's where you went to hang out if you weren't at home. That's where we hung out. There was a snack bar there. You could actually get American hamburgers because you didn't get, they had no McDonald's back then. They had no Kentucky Fried Chicken, no American food at all, except for the base cafeteria or the teen club. So that was our hangout.
And even though Barbara, Margaret, and all of the other kids were living in Germany on a base, they were still engaging in those quintessential high school experiences, and this included high school dances, and these were all held at the base's quote-unquote teen club. And one of these dances was held on June 8th of 1963, and this was a Saturday night.
And when I tell you this story, you're going to say, Barb, you're making this up just for the podcast. No, I'm not. You can talk to my sister, my sister-in-law. You can talk to Lynn Schneider. There's a group of us that still know each other. But this is part of what I think kept this in my mind for all these years. So Margaret is very plain. She has curly hair, but she doesn't fix it. She doesn't wear makeup, but I didn't either. I mean, we were 15, but she was very plain. She wouldn't wear any clothing that was the least bit suggestive. And I think that's because her dad was a minister and probably very picky. She was plain Jane. And because she was so quiet and so timid, you could be in a room with 30 people and nobody even noticed her. And I just, you know, that's kind of sad. And I can't tell you why this particular dance, we decided to do this, but Kathy Clark was one of my best friends. Loretta Harlow was one of my best friends who ended up marrying my brother. She's now my sister-in-law. And I decided that we were going to fix Margaret up for the dance. They said it was a church dance. No, it wasn't. It was the end of the school year dance at the teen club. There was one every year. There was a dance every, I swear, at least once a month there was a dance. So we went to Kathy's house because Kathy's family had a lot of money, personal money, not military money. Kathy had the best clothes. Kathy wore tons of makeup, too much. So we go together to her house, and we went through Kathy's closet and picked out a cream, sort of light, woolish cream skirt that sort of flared out from the hips, and a creamy white, it felt like cashmere, a sweater that fit Margaret tighter than anything she had ever worn because she had big boobs. I mean, for a girl who's 15, she was built. And so Kathy did her makeup. We did her hair. We spent the whole afternoon together. And Margaret felt like $1 million. She was so proud. She held her head up like she never did at school when I saw her when she left. She was so excited. Now, I think now that I look back on it, we did that because her dad would never have allowed that. So we knew we get her to Kathy's, fix her up. She can go to the dance. Her parents will never know.
So even though Barbara got ready with her friends, she didn't actually go with them to the dance.
My dad was an Army colonel, and sometimes he was just a badass. And he decided, you don't need to go. You go to too many things, and I just want you home. So I went home. I didn't go to the dance. When they got there, they kind of split up. Again, everybody knew everybody else. So the dance ended. Kathy Clark went home with a bunch of friends. Lynn Schneider went with her friends to go party somewhere. And Loretta went with her friends. All three of them saw Margaret as she walked out of the teen club. And the base was small, so she probably lived, you know, it might have been a 10-minute walk. And Lynn and her group and Loretta and her group were passing by and said, hey, do you want us to walk? You want to walk with us? We're going in your direction. We'll walk you home. And she said no to both of them.
Meanwhile, Barbara is home. She stays home on this Saturday night, the night that they are having the end of year dance. But she is woken up very, very early to a very confusing, perplexing, and kind of unnerving situation.
We lived off base in a German house, and the two police showed up at our German house and wanted to talk to me. I wish I could tell you exactly what time the MPs came.
MPs, military police.
My memory is that I was in PJs and my dad came upstairs and brought me downstairs. So I'm thinking very early morning, like 6 a.m. So I sit down with them and I'm like, what the hell? And they wouldn't tell me exactly what happened. They just kept asking, where was I yesterday? What did I do? Who did I hang out with? So I gave them what information I could, and then they left. And of course, my dad and mom were sitting there, and I said, what do you think is going on? Well, since we didn't have a phone, there was no way to find out.
Barbara and her family were left in the dark about the strange home visit made by the military police officers until later that day.
My mother took us to church later in the day, and our Catholic priest brought it up at the sermon. And that's when I found out it was Margaret.
Margaret Williams had been strangled and sexually assaulted. Her body was found on a baseball field adjacent to the teen club where the dance had been held the previous night.
Tell you, I can't tell you what I felt back then. You know, I sat down and cried. I know we had a service for her. I think I was in shock, mostly.
Here's what happened. After the dance ended, Margaret's parents were up waiting for her to come home. And once midnight had come and gone, her father reported her missing. The search for Margaret led to the discovery of her half-dressed, strangled, and battered body. And she was lying in the middle of a baseball diamond behind where the teen club was. And she was callously left there like trash after being sexually assaulted. And she was still wearing parts of the outfit that she had borrowed from her friend when she was getting ready for the dance the day before.
When she was murdered, I mean, it affected the entire base hugely. Her dad was the Protestant minister on base. He was the only minister for that whole base. Now, I can't tell you for sure right now exactly what I went through emotionally, but because I remember that time, those few days, so vividly, I know that it affected me.
Margaret's murder shocked and horrified everyone at the base. And the first reason, obviously, is because it's an incredible loss when anyone is murdered, let alone a 15-year-old girl. And the second reason is that the person who did it had to be one of them. And everyone on this base was like an extended member of the same family. So who could do this to Margaret and just leave her there?
When the military police began investigating, they started with a boy who Margaret was rumored to have a crush on, Shorty Rogers.
She, at the time, was sort of in love with an African-American boy named Shorty Rogers.
So while Margaret had a crush on Shorty Rogers and they sort of gravitated towards each other, I want to be clear in that nothing had happened yet. Margaret was a quintessential daughter of a minister. She was a really, really good girl. This is just somebody she meshed with. And the police heard pretty early on that they had this kind of friendship connection. Maybe there's more. Maybe there's an emotional connection. And that's always the first person the police are going to want to speak to.
They went to Shorty Rogers' house first because all the people who had been at the teen club knew that she liked Shorty Rogers. His family was due to leave for the States, like in the next week.
While it is always a smart idea to start with the romantic interest when you're conducting an investigation, Shorty Rogers had an alibi. Now, while the police had heard Shorty's name, right? Shorty is the one who Margaret likes. They, in the course of their investigation, when they were questioning the students about who Margaret had been seen with that night, who Margaret had been seen with outside the teen club after the dance, who Margaret was in the periphery of, the same name came up over and over again. And that was John Getrue.
How it turned to John is, who knows, maybe Shorty saw her dancing with John. Maybe somebody who was leaving the teen club saw her finally walk with John. That I don't know. But when they went looking for John, he was walking his family dog like nobody's business. Like it never happened.
When they brought John in for questioning, he completely denied having any part in what happened to Margaret. He played dumb. But slowly his story started to shift. He then said that after the dance, he met her outside and they went on a walk. Then his story shifted again. In this new version, he said they eventually had sex, but he certainly didn't kill her.
Then he revised his story yet again, admitting to having sex with her, admitting to choking her, but denying killing her. At least he didn't intend to, if that's what happened.
And word of what had happened to Margaret spread throughout the base, and Barbara was horrified to hear who was responsible.
Yeah, Barbara was horrified because, like we said, This is a very tight-knit situation. You're living overseas on a very small base. Everyone knows everyone. You kind of consider everyone an extended family, and it's how we've referenced this situation prior. John Getru was not a stranger to Barbara. She knew him. She had walked home with him. He had offered to walk her home multiple times. They were very familiar with each other. The horror of realizing that John killed Margaret, these two people she knew pretty well, for a 15-year-old brain is a lot to deal with.
I know that I was shocked. I know that I was scared because I knew that John had ripped me home. As a woman, you start thinking, am I missing something? Why wasn't I aware? Why aren't I more careful? You know, why did I let him walk me home? John was at the dance. John was a great dancer. I used to love to dance with him. And so my guess is he saw her in a different light because she looked so good. But she was so timid and so shy that I think, like the true ripper that he was, he thought, oh, good, I'm going to try to get her. Maybe she'll go make out with me.
Like we said, Margaret, she was just starting to toy with the idea of liking a boy. Her dad was this staunch, buttoned-up minister at the base. So it's not surprising that if John Getru had come on to her in the dark, in the middle of the night, behind the teen club, she may have been very uncomfortable with that.
And all we can assume is that John was waiting for her and found her outside the teen club where they all left. And she was found the next morning behind the teen club, lying on the baseball diamond, strangled with her pantyhose and raped. So I think she was starting to kind of sneak around with Shorty, but I don't think she had any sexual experience at all. So when John said, let's just walk and talk, and then he tried to make out with her, it probably terrified her. And when she panicked, that's when he killed her. I said, the three of us, Loretta, Kathy, and I, when we got together the following week, we said, this is our fault. We made her look gorgeous. She was wearing a tight sweater. John wouldn't have noticed her if it hadn't been for that. You know what I mean? Now, as an adult, I know, I mean, I can't really take the blame for that, but still, that was so weird.
There are assholes out there, and there are predators, and this guy was just, you know, the idea that he wasn't looking at her before because she wasn't, you know, aesthetically pleasing or made up. If it wasn't her, it would have been somebody else.
I think it's really interesting when Barbara said that she felt guilty, like she did this nice thing for her friend. It's like a quintessential 80s movie montage. You know, you make up your friend who's a little bit more timid. You want to make her feel great before a dance. And then suddenly what happened. And for them to feel guilty, I mean, I understand that, but it's not valid and it's not her fault, obviously. But we hear shit like this all the time.
Right. So I think there's two prongs to this. One is what you're talking about, where it's like the 80s movie. It literally reminds me of She's All That, right? Where it's like the dorky girl that's getting a makeover and then all the guys like
She's
her.
All That is spot on. Like that 90s, like coming down the staircase in the red dress scene.
Yeah. And it kind of goes back to, you know, the what was she wearing kind of conversation. And it's a load of bullshit at the end of the day. Like, it doesn't matter how cute she looked that night or whatever. I don't think that, you know, when it comes to her guilt in that situation, you know, that of course you're going to feel that because you have this personal connection with the person. But I don't think, you know, as an outsider, that there should be any guilt kind of tied to that. Well, and at the end of the day, too, I think that thought is almost like brings us back to this like misogynistic way of thinking, where it's like you can't be beautiful, you can't be done up, you can't wear a pretty dress, you can't do this, or else you're going to be vulnerable to something like this happening to you, where it's that is not the case whatsoever. And that in itself is a fucked up ass backwards way of thinking.
You're telling women, all your focus should be on being as pretty as you can, but don't be too pretty because otherwise it's justified if someone f-ing rapes and kills you.
Absolutely. So we're pretty much doing everything from the comfort of our own home these days. And guess what? You can color your hair and it will look good with Madison Reed. Take coloring your hair at home to the next level with Madison Reed. You can get gorgeous professional hair color delivered to your door starting at $22. You know, for decades, women have had two options for coloring their hair. It's either outdated at home color or the time and expense of a traditional salon. But many Madison Reed clients comment on how their new hair color has improved their lives. Women love the results. It's gorgeous, shiny, multidimensional, healthy-looking hair. And this game-changing color you can do at home and look as if you just came from the salon. And what makes Madison Reed Color unique is that it's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous, multidimensional shades. Find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. And our listeners can get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit with code FIRSTDEGREEPODCAST. That's code FIRSTDEGREEPODCAST at madison-reed.com. Madison-reed.com, code first degree podcast. Did you know that right now Geico is offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies? That's 15% on top of the money Geico could already save you. So what are you waiting for? Your dog to make you breakfast in bed with Belgian waffles? As nice as that sounds, it's probably never going to happen. But at least there's never been a better time to switch to Geico. Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Visit geico.com to learn more. In 1963, John Arthur Getrue was 18 years old. He was born in 1944, and he and his family were natives of Newark, Ohio. Germany wasn't the only place he'd lived with his family. He'd also spent time on bases in Japan, Hawaii, and North Carolina.
His family had come to Germany. They were stationed at BK. And when he was at school, he'd get kicked out of class all the time. He had anger management issues big time. I knew that. Everybody knew that. But I was friendly to him. I was a cheerleader. He was on the football team. I said he danced great. I would dance with him whenever we were at the team club. And if it was night and I lived off base, about a 30-minute walk, he'd walk me home. Heck, he walked me home all the time. Now, I never liked him. In fact, if you ask different people about John, he got in trouble a lot at school, and he was a darker character, and people would say, oh, he's kind of creepy. Again, I kind of felt for him. He came to Germany a year late, and through the rumor mill, we heard that he had been either at juvie or in some treatment center in Ohio. His father then was stationed in Germany, and he came when his time was up, whatever it was. Do I have proof of that? No. But that's the rumor that went around.
John was ultimately charged with rape and murder, but under German law, he would be tried in juvenile court. During the trial, the defense argued that John was drunk when he killed Margaret. John took the stand, and according to a 1964 Newark Advocate article, he said, quote, "I raped her, but it did not occur to me that I could have killed her. I just wanted to knock her out." During the trial, John disparaged Margaret's character and claimed that she was throwing herself at him, suggesting that it was her fault that she ended up dead.
And the defense blamed heavy petting for, quote, knocking Getrue loose from his senses. They also claimed that the sex was consensual, but there was zero evidence of a romantic relationship between Margaret and John.
When he was in German court, he blamed Margaret. He said she came on to him. And I knew her, and I knew that was a lie. And once he was taken away to the German courts, it was never brought up. My dad never mentioned it. It was never mentioned again. Again, that's what the military does. So weird. And I wish I could say, here's the thing though. There's a lot of things. I have a really bad memory when it comes to my youth, mostly because we moved so much. It's hard to put things in the right boxes in your head. But I remember the day we fixed her up like it was yesterday. I remember the next day like it was yesterday, and I've never, ever, ever forgotten about it. And just about once a decade, when I get together with Loretta or my sister and I are talking, his name and her name would come up. Or if somebody would talk about things that happened when you were young, and I'd say, well, listen to this story. And then I'd say, wonder what happened to him. Did he stay in German jail forever? Did he come back to the States? Is he dead?
Did John Getrou stay in German jail forever? Is he dead? No and no. Although both would have been better alternatives to the reality of what became of John.
John was sentenced to 10 years, which was the maximum for the charges he was facing. But since he was an alien in Germany and also considered a juvenile under their law, the court said that John may be released on parole after only 2 years.
And after this pathetic excuse for a sentence was handed down, John addressed the court. He said, quote, I am deeply sorry for her parents, and if I could do something to bring her back, I would.
John was released from that German prison after serving only 2 years. 2 years for admitting to raping and then killing a 15-year-old girl.
And there's no denying that there are problems with how the military handles not only murder, but sexual assault. And how Margaret's murder was handled is perhaps not that different than how it would be handled today. Just look at the numbers. The Department of Defense doesn't keep any kind of military sex offender registry that could potentially alert soldiers and commanders, let alone law enforcement, to the presence of military sexual predators. And this is bananas. Why wouldn't they keep track of this? What could the excuse possibly be? Well, in 2015, the Department of Defense amended their protocols and they started submitting names of convicted offenders to the National Sex Offender Registry and the National Sex Offender Public website. But very few names are making their way on this list.
And according to a 2019 New York Times article, reported the following. According to the latest figures, there were about 6,000 unrestricted reports of sexual assault in the military in 2019. But only about 300 cases had been prosecuted. And keep in mind that it's likely that only 50% of sexual assaults are reported in the military. And the main reason people give for the reason why they don't report them is retribution. One thing I did see is that there's an estimated that 25% of women in the military are sexually assaulted.
I read one in 16.
Really?
And I just subscribed to the New York Times and paid to get past their paywall while researching for this. But they were saying 1 in 16 because the military is only 20% women, essentially, but makes up like 90% of the sexual assaults, of course. So the fact that there are so few women and the percentages are so high, that's what they can deduce based on the data. And they pull 100,000 military soldiers. But yeah, no, it's a huge problem. And clearly it was a problem in 1963. It's a problem now. So obviously in the military, there is this culture that thrives on silence. And it's a culture that's skilled at sweeping things under the rug and allowing potentially violent criminals the opportunity to continue to rape and potentially escalate to more.
I knew John was dark. I knew that he had really piercing eyes. Piercing eyes. His eyes were like black, kind of like Ted Bundy, those kind of eyes. But was I scared of him? Hell no. Not a bit. But I should have been.
And what Barbara just said rings true. She wasn't scared of John. Hell no. But she should have been. Because unfortunately, Margaret's life would not be the last one that John Getrou would take.
Much like how thoughts of John Getrou became less and less prevalent in Barbara's mind, he slipped back into the U.S. quietly. With the murder he'd committed having happened overseas, he could really just fly under the radar. And his parents never shared what their son had done. And the military, for the most part, swept this whole thing right under the rug. And he lived in relative obscurity. And that was until 2017.
It wasn't until the massive search for the Golden State Killer that John Getrou became a blip on law enforcement radar. Margaret Williams had a little brother named Evan. And he's 7.5 years old when his sister was killed by John Getrou. Eventually, Margaret's family moved back to the States to be stationed at a U.S. base. And Evan grew up and became a pastor, working in the church just like his father had.
And of course, even though Evan was young when his sister was murdered, that's not something that leaves your mind. So all of these years later, when the FBI announced this revived effort to catch and capture the Golden State Killer, Evan heard about that, and he started doing some research, and he found that John Getrue was living in Northern California while the Golden State Killer was active in Northern California.
So when he called the police, Evan said, I don't know that this guy is the Golden State Killer, and he may not be, and you may think I'm crazy, but there is a man who killed my sister when he was 18, and he lives in that area. So he was thinking that the Golden State Killer might be John Getrue. Some of the dates were so similar to when John had been in California, because he had done some research. You've got to trace this man's DNA. And they said, well, we can't just go get his DNA. We don't have any. And how do we match it? And then they did that genealogy and found a cousin back in Ohio. And, you know, I guess you know how they match the different things on the DNA, and found a match. Then they started looking at all the Getrues. You know, can we find any of the Getrues? And then they found, oh, there is one. He is in Palo Alto. And so then they made the connections. We have to thank the detective department, too. You know, some police departments, they go, we don't care. That was 50 years ago. So when the police started researching it and found out that he was, you know, the security guard at Stanford and all of this other stuff, then they found out, no, it's not the Golden State Killer, but this guy might have killed some people.
So as we know, John Getrue is not the Golden State Killer. But John Getrue and Joseph DeAngelo are very much connected. They are part of the same club, both in their 70s, both living in Northern California, both serial offenders who long thought they had gotten away with their crimes, and both were caught as a result of genetic genealogy.
So John Getrue's DNA was found on the murdered remains of 21-year-old Leslie Merle Perlov, and she was killed in 1973. His DNA was also found on the body of 21-year-old Janet Ann Taylor, who was killed in 1974. Both women were murdered near Stanford University. And these are just cases that we know about so far. Law enforcement officers are working to piece together a timeline of his life. But here's what we do know. John ultimately became a father, he became a husband three times over, and he held down multiple jobs without really drawing any attention while he was living this double life as a serial killer.
It's gone. I started thinking, okay, I did all the things that when you're older, you think, okay, I graduated high school, I had boyfriends, I bought my first car, I taught in my first school, I got married, I had my babies, they grew up, all of that. Margaret got nothing. Did he have his eye on her before? I don't know. I don't know. Did he hurt someone back in the States before he came to Germany? I don't know. And that man has lived like a slime 15 minutes away from Stanford his whole life. I think that we walk among murderers, rapists every day, and we don't know it. I'm convinced. We don't know it.
And then we come full circle to this notion of military brats and the transient nomadic characteristics of this lifestyle.
When John went to jail and his family went back to the States, so he got 2 years for killing a girl, and his parents acted like it never happened. They never told anybody, nothing. He got away with murder. You know, the military is very good about keeping that stuff secret. They don't, I mean, if you went back right now to the military and tried to find more about it, they're very closed-mouthed.
John stayed under the radar for decades. He was able to live in obscurity. He was hard to find. He was hard to track down. And this helped him get away with murder.
Our parents treated us like soldiers. You will do what I say. If I say jump, you say how high. When you're in the military, you don't have a home. We didn't come back to a home. Well, and again, everybody, once your tour was up, you came back to the States. It's hard to find Army brats.
The number of cities, the number of victims that could be connected to John Getrue is nearly impossible to predict at this time. But hypothetically speaking, these numbers could be staggering, as we've seen with people like Joseph DeAngelo. What he was able to do in just a short number of years was devastating. And this guy could be Joseph DeAngelo's counterpart in some ways.
Okay, so huge, huge thank you to Barbara for being our first degree this episode, and she'll also be with us next week as we take you through the sordid and elusive life of John Getchrue, his known crimes, and the stunning parallels between he and Joseph D'Angelo, the serial killer that ironically prompted his capture. And until then, if you have a story you'd like to tell us, please email us at hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram @thefirstdegreepodcast, @AlexisLinkletter, @BillyJensen, @JackFanick. Please join our Facebook group. We're talking true crime all the time. And stick around because we're going to kill some time and talk about the Golden State Killer
and how he pled guilty.
And remember, only you can prevent serial killers. And keep your friends close.
But not that close. And 6 feet away. Still, wear your mask.
Social distancing, bitches.
Happy chicken wing day, everyone. Live your best life. Order some wingies.
Oh, chicken wings!
Bye. Sources for today's episode includes Palo Alto Online, The Newark Advocate, The New York Times, The LA Times, USA Today, court documents, and as always, our first degree guest is always our largest source.
All right. Well, welcome to today's episode of Killing Time. So this is a very monumental week in the true crime world. Disclaimer, we are recording this on Monday, so we're 2 days kind of behind of where this is airing. But Golden State Killer pled guilty to avoid the death penalty. And obviously, my two co-hosts were very involved in this entire story. And, you know, I feel like they might have a few opinions of what's going on.
Yeah, it was crazy. I watched for as much as I could today because it was televised. They did it in a ballroom and he was wearing that plastic shield thingy. And it was, he's so gross.
Yeah.
And they just, I mean, and he didn't have to disclose anything. He just kept saying, I admit. Piece when they were reading the charges, and it was super descriptive and it was so, he's so gross. Hate that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, they were, you've never seen a more punchable face. And he just sat there, like Lex was saying, you know, he would say, I admit, he'd say guilty, he'd say, yes, your honor, and he'd say no. I think those are all the words that he said.
Wow.
But, you know, a couple of new things that did come out is things that I didn't know is that when he was first arrested, he was trying to set up an alter ego defense. So when he was first arrested in the room, he was saying, I did it. But then I finally got rid of Jerry and Jerry got out of my body. And then I was able to live a happy life.
So his alter ego was named Jerry. Also the alter ego of my lovely boyfriend, Jared.
Coincidence? I think not.
Oh, no. This is bad. I'll take you, Jer.
The polar opposite of the Golden State Killer is Jared.
Yeah. The funny Jared's alter ego, Jerry, was created because he's so goofy and kind and and silly and wonderful. So it's pretty much the opposite alter ego. So he created this defense kind of thing before he was arrested or right after?
Right after he was arrested, when he was in the room, they described what he said. And he said that he mentioned this Jerry thing, kind of like the way that, you know, you see a lot of, you know, Son of Sam or Ted Bundy with a dark passenger. You see a lot of that when they're saying that they were kind of possessed or they were split personalities. It was all bullshit. And he, you know, they were, you know, somebody also brought up, is he faking? You know, and they didn't want to come out right out and say he's faking, but they brought up also.
Of course he is.
Absolutely. But they couldn't say it. I don't know. Maybe because of HIPAA laws or something. Who knows? But they can say that, no, he's definitely faking it. But they did say that when he was first arrested for the shoplifting, the dog repellent and the hammer, he faked a heart attack.
Oh God.
Which we had, I'd never read before either. So that was, he's constantly a kind of guy that like would fake stuff in order to get out. And that's what he's doing right now. So him sitting there, you know, they talked about how, you know, anybody that watched it, you saw how feeble he looked. He was like that from day one when he was arrested. But 2 days before he was arrested, he was flying down the highway or the freeway, as they call it, in California.
Like 70, 80 miles an hour, avoiding cop cars and helicopters and shit. And under his daughter's car, like wrenching and fixing it.
Yeah. Was he doing the same kind of thing, like, you know, when Harvey Weinstein got arrested and then he appeared in court and he was like on a walker, like super frail. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's like,
and he trying lost to get a bunch people of to feel really fast. He lost a bunch of weight really fast, which made him look a lot older. And he's got this really weak voice. I mean, if you look at what victims were saying back in the 70s about his voice, it's about how high-pitched it is. And even now, I mean, when he was saying, "I admit," he's like, "admit." Like, he sounds like it's a high-pitched, like, really old-ass, high-pitched man. And I'm like, this is exactly how they describe it. He's disgusting. But I actually I have an interesting story about him from when he was first arrested. So as we know, I mean, nobody knew that he was a serial killer, including his children. And I guess once he was arrested, of course, the children are shocked. And you have to know, like, Joe DeAngelo, he's been wearing a mask his entire life. I mean, he was the most prolific double life serial killer I've ever heard about. And his family didn't know. And he had only daughters and granddaughters, which ironically. And I guess, like, I think, so when the daughters found out, they were brought in to see him and they could go into the interrogation room and talk to him like, "Oh my God, Dad, say this isn't true. Tell me this is a lie. Like, this can't be."
Right.
And he was completely stone faced and he was just like, "Get the f- out" to his kids. Cause it's like the jig was up. He didn't have to pretend to be dad anymore. He didn't have to pretend to be like, and he was like, "Just get the f- out." Like, it was just, it sounded to me as the story was relayed like a relief. And like, if I don't have to pretend anymore, if my I've been exposed, my self-preservation tactic, it's all gone, then I don't even have to pretend to be this f-ing dad guy anymore, because that's not who I am. Because if you kill that many people and rape that many people and burgle that many houses, like, that's really who he is.
Right.
Like, he spent a lot less time pretending to be that than he was pretending to be dad. Dad was like the labored facade. You know what I mean? Like, organically, authentically, he's that guy. And he's just so fascinating and terrifying. I hate him.
I have a question about that. Was he, because I actually don't know as much as I probably should about GSA, considering I'm so close with both of you. Was he, when he was being an actual father to his kids and grandfather, was he a good one? Like, was it like a BTK thing where his daughter like always thought that he was a good father?
So what I've heard, and I don't know what Billy's heard, is just like, he was a dad who like put food on the table and like put a roof over the head, but like wasn't overly engaged.
It was like a little bit detached.
Yeah. It just sounds like it was sort of like a really old school family model where it less was expected emotionally of him, maybe. And he was like a provider, and that's sort of more it. But I mean, he was living with one of his daughters and his granddaughter in his house when he was arrested. So not the mom, like, he was cohabitating with a daughter and his grandbaby girl. Right. So he was certainly engaged enough and probably helping this daughter out.
Yeah. And, you know, from what I've heard, exactly what Lex said, just sort of that kind of old school dynamic. He puts food on the table, but he was like a cranky, curmudgeon-y guy, at least towards the end there, yelling at people, yelling at neighbors, that kind of thing. So it wasn't like he was a super nice guy on the outside.
Oh God, what a crazy thing. So is there anything else that you had learned through watching the thing today, either of you?
Only more details of the brutality of the crimes. So I knew about all of these crimes really well. So by the way, the show I did, Unmasking a Killer, is rerunning. And obviously Billy's show on HBO premiered last night. So there's lots to watch right now, but there was
by
a
the
lot
way,
that was
sorry. the timing of that is also f-ing crazy.
I know, it's really ironic.
Insane.
It's so ironic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The timing and all this stuff has been surreal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But no, I just learned some more details because when they were reading the counts against him and then he had to say either guilty or I admit, the guy who was reading it was really emotional. And I think he was an attorney. I missed his name. But when he was reading just the descriptions of the murders, like Manuela Witthoon's murder and Janelle Cruz's murder, like I didn't know Janelle Cruz had teeth knocked out. I didn't know, you know what I mean? Like there were certain little like details about how awful and how brutal these crimes were that I wasn't aware of. Yeah. But nothing shockingly new other than just they're always just even worse than you imagine because you can't even imagine like the fear and the brutality that you're experiencing as you're being killed.
Yeah, particularly. And I think that was the guy from OC and particularly with Janelle talking about the teeth and how much blood she had swallowed as well. Just that awful.
Terrible.
Yeah, he was definitely going for the, you know, he was trying to make a statement. When he went up there, because there were different, because he was so prolific across so many different jurisdictions.
He was getting choked up. I was like moved by him. I loved him. And I don't know who is he a DA or something, but I thought he was great.
Yeah, he's an ADA down there, I believe. And, but you had all different, you had like a woman who was very soft spoken from one county, you know, it was all different counties because he was so prolific. So you had people just a cast coming up there and, you know, it started at 9:30 and it didn't end until I think it was 5 with a lunch break and a couple little breaks in between. But, you know, we don't know the victim statements, I believe are going to happen around sentencing. Sentencing is going to be on August 17th or around there, barring any kind of, delays or anything like that.
Yeah. Didn't people clap because they said his penis was small?
Yes, that was a, so, they were talking about, Jane Doe 20, and the woman who was reading Jane Doe 20's account, Jane Doe number 20, I believe, is the one who had said, when asked for a physical description, he said he had a tiny penis, and that matched up with a lot of, with almost every other woman that he had assaulted. And then there was a pause, and then there was enthusiastic applause.
Oh my God. So did they show his face during any of this?
You could see, I have a video of it up on my Twitter. It's just, his face was the same. He's not going to change anything. Yeah.
I mean, listen, I am against body shaming of any kind unless it is towards a motherfucker like this guy. Yeah. So please call out the size of his tiny, tiny little dick all day, every day.
Mm-hmm. I hate that guy. Like what a insane thing to do with your time in your life. What a crazy thing to do. I can't.
I mean, it's unbelievable, but I'm so, I mean, it has been like such a wild ride because I've been friends with Alexis for 15 years, but since we started the podcast, like you both were in your respective lanes of trying to find the guy and it happened while I think the first year that we were doing the podcast, and I remember the text from Billy at like 11 p.m. the day before they announced it. So it's been like such an interesting and a crazy experience kind of watching it and then watching you guys too through the whole thing.
Well, what's crazy about it is that like I don't know that we would have a podcast without GSK, which is like Billy and I met because of this. Jack, we were going to do a podcast. Like, we wanted a dude. And, like, there's no other guy who could.
It wouldn't be the
what
first
other crime guys are there? And, no, it is just
could
like.
Put up with our bullshit, Alexis.
I mean, I have so much bullshit. I don't understand how anyone talks to me. But, it's a weird. He's a very polarizing figure, at least in my life, because so much good has come as a result of like this obsession over him. But then you look at, of course, like Michelle McNamara, and it's like, do you call that good or bad, that obsession? You know, she's not here, but look at what happened. So I don't know, you know, like he's very polarizing, I'm sure, to a lot of people.
Well, it's interesting. It's just the ripple effects of somebody And
a cosmic shuffling of the deck.
It is. And it is interesting because that person's presence in the world and all of the horrible things that they have done, the ripple effect affects so many people's lives in so many different ways and people that are so far removed from him. So it is interesting to kind of think about that. Well,
even in the case we discussed today, I mean, the brother of Margaret called thinking that this guy was GSK, and that's how the lid got blown off of this second potential very prolific serial killer, which, you know, that'll remain to be seen. But it is, you know, I'm sure he's a central figure in a lot of people's stories because the reach is so vast when you've hurt that many people.
Yeah. Right. And also there's the I think it's over 100 right now, of cases that have been solved, murder cases that have been solved with genetic genealogy, and he was able to open the floodgates for that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Damn.
Well, we'll have lots more to talk about next week, too. I mean, this is a two-parter.
Right.
So there are a million parallels between, and I do think it's fascinating to look at GSK versus John, the guy we discussed today, because there are so many like stunning parallels that we are going to get into. Because maybe this serial killer archetype is more pronounced than we originally thought, because GSK does seem so unique, but maybe he's not. And that's terrifying.
And I'm also sure that statement alone probably like is another jab to him too. So fuck you, dude.
Yeah, dude, you're not that fucking interesting.
No.
Nope.
No. All right. Well,
Joe D'Angelo.
We call it
time. Yeah, we calling it 16 on the dot.